The archetypal situation always cited by Sartre to demonstrate the irreducibility of freedom merely underlines this. With a predetermined reality, freedom becomes a vacant claim. Herbert Marcuse has exposed the absurdity of the philosophical theorem that it is always possible inwardly either to accept or to reject martyrdom. Footnote 3, text. Yet this is precisely what Sartre's dramatic situation are designed to demonstrate. But his plays are nevertheless bad models of his own existentialism because they display in their respect for truth the whole administered universe which his philosophy ignores. The lesson we learn from them is one of unfreedom. Sartre's theater of ideas sabotages the aims of his categories. This is not an individual inadequacy of his plays. It is not the office of art to spotlight alternatives, but to resist by its form alone the course of the world which permanently puts a pistol to men's head. In fact, as soon as committed works of art do instigate decisions at their own level, the decisions themselves become interchangeable. Because of his ambiguity, Sartre has with great candor confessed that he expects no real changes in the world from literature, a skepticism which reflects both the historical mutation of society and of the practical function of literature since the days of Voltaire. The principle of commitment thus slides toward the proclivities of the author in keeping with the extreme subjectivism of Sartre's philosophy, which for all its materialist undertones still audibly echoes German speculative idealism. In his literary theory, the work of art becomes an appeal to subjects because it is itself nothing other than a declaration by a subject of his own choice or failure to choose. Sartre will not allow that every work of art by its inception alone confronts the writer, however free he may be, with objective demands of composition. His intention becomes simply one element among them. Sartre's question, why write, and his solution of it in a deeper choice are invalid because the author's motivations are irrelevant to the finished work, the literary product. Page 305. Sartre himself is not so far from his view when he notes that the stature of works increases the less they remain attached to the empirical person who created them, as Hegel saw long ago. When he calls the literary work in Durkheim's language a social fact, he again involuntarily recalls its inherently collective objectivity, impenetrable to the mere subjective intentions of the author. Sartre, therefore, does not want to situate commitment at the level of the intention of the writer, but at that of his humanity itself. Footnote 4, text. This determination, however, is so generic that commitment ceases to be distinct from any other form of human action or attitude. The point, says Sartre, is that the writer commits himself in the present, dans le présent. But since he, in any case, cannot escape it, his commitment to it cannot indicate a program. The actual obligation a writer undertakes is much more precise. It is not one of choice, but of substance. Also, Sartre talks of the dialectic, his subjectivism. So little registers the particular other for which the subject must first divest itself to become a subject, that he suspects every literary objectification of petrifaction. However, since the pure immediacy and spontaneity which he hopes to save encounters no resistance in his work by which they could define themselves, they undergo a second reification. In order to develop his drama and novel beyond sheer declaration, whose recurrent model is the scream of the tortured, Sartre has to seek recourse in a flat objectivity, subtracted from any dialectic of form and expression that is simply a communication of his own philosophy. The content of his art becomes philosophy, as with no other writer except Schiller. But however sublime, thoughts can never be much more than one of the materials for art. Sartre's plays are vehicles for the author's ideas which have been left behind in the race of aesthetic forms. They operate with traditional intrigues, exalted by an unshaken faith in meanings which can be transferred from art to reality. But the thesis they illustrate, or where possibly state, misuse the emotions which Sartre's own drama aims to express by making them examples. They thereby disavow themselves. When one of his most famous plays ends with the dictum, "Hell is other people," it sounds like a quotation from Being and Nothingness, and it might just as well have been. Hell is ourselves, the combination of solid plot and equally solid, extractable idea won Sartre great success and made him, without doubt, against his honest will, acceptable to the culture industry. The high level of abstraction of such thesis art led him into the mistake of letting some of his best works, the film Le Jeu Sans Fait, or the plays Les Mésalées, be performed as political events and not just to an audience of victims in the dark. Page 306. In much the same way, the current ideology which Sartre detests confuses the actions and sufferings of paper leaders with the objective movement of history. Interwoven in the veil of personalization is the idea that human beings are in control and decide, not anonymous machinery, and that there is life on the commanding heights of society. Beckett's moribund grotesques suggests the truth about that. Sartre's vision prevents him from recognizing the hell he revolts against. Many of his phrases could be parroted by his mortal enemies. The idea that decisions as such is that counts would even cover the Nazi slogan that only sacrifice makes us free. In fascist Italy, Gentiles about dynamism made similar pronouncements in philosophy. The flaw in his conception of commitment strikes at the very cause to which Sartre wishes to commit himself. Brecht's didacticism. Brecht, in some of his plays, such as the dramatization of Gorky's The Mother or The Measures Taken, bluntly chloroflies the party. But at times, at least according to his theoretical writings, he too wanted to educate spectators to a new attitude that would be distanced, thoughtful, experimental, the reverse of illusory empathy and identification. In tendency to abstraction, his plays after Saint Joan trump those of Sartre. The difference is that Brecht, more consistent than Sartre and a greater artist, made this abstraction into the formal principle of his art as a didactic poetics that eliminates the traditional concept of dramatic character altogether. He realized that the surface of social life, the sphere of consumption, which includes the psychologically motivated action of individuals, occludes the essence of society, which, as the law of exchange, it itself abstract. Brecht rejected aesthetic individualism as an ideology. He therefore thought to translate the true hideousness of society into theatrical appearance by dragging it straight out from its camouflage. The people on his stage shrink before our eyes into the agents of social processes and functions, which indirectly and unknowingly they are in empirical reality. Brecht no longer postulates, like Sartre, an identity between living individuals and the essence of society, let alone any absolute sovereignty of the subject. Nevertheless, the process of aesthetic reduction that he pursues for the sake of political truth, in fact, gets in its way. For this truth involves innumerable mediations which Brecht disdains. What is artistically legitimate as alienating infantilism, Brecht's first place came from the same milieu as Dada, becomes merely infantile when it starts to claim theoretical or social validity. Page 307. Brecht wanted to reveal an image, the inner nature of capitalism. In this sense, his aim was indeed what he disguised it as against Stalinist terror, realistic. He would have refused to deprive social essence of meaning by talking it as it appeared, imageless and blind in a single crippled life. But he burdened him with the obligation of ensuring that what he intended to make unequivocally clear was theoretically correct. His art, however, refused to accept his quid pro quo. It both represents itself as didactic and claims aesthetic dispensation from responsibility for the accuracy of what it teaches. Criticism of Brecht cannot overlook the fact that he did not, for objective reasons beyond the adequacy of his own creations, fulfill the norm he sets himself as it were a salvation. Saint Joan was the central work of his dialectical theater. The Good Woman of Szechuan is a variation of it in reverse, where Joan assists evil by the immediacy of her goodness. Gente, who wills the good, must become evil. The play is set in a Chicago halfway between the Wild West fables of mahogany and economic facts. But the more preoccupied Brecht becomes with information and the less he looks for images, the more he misses the essence of capitalism which the parable is supposed to present. Mere episodes in the sphere of circulation in which competitors maul each other are recounted instead of appropriation of surplus value in the sphere of production. Compared with which the prowls of cattle dealers over their shares of the booty are epiphenomena incapable of provoking any great crises. Moreover, the economic transactions presented as the machinations of rapacious traders are not merely puerile, which is how Brecht seems to have meant them. They are also unintelligible by the criteria of even the most primitive economic logic. The observe of the latter is a political naivete, which could only make Brecht's opponents grin at the thought of such an ingenious enemy. They could be as comfortable with Brecht as they are with the dying Joan in the impressive final scene of the play, even with the broadest mind allowance for poetic license. The idea that a strike leadership pact by the party could entrust such a crucial task to a non-member is as inconceivable as the subsequent idea that the failure of that individual could ruin the whole strike. Brecht's treatment of fascism. Brecht's comedy of the irresistible rise of the great dictator, Arturo Uy, exposes the subjective nullity and pretense of a fascist leader in a harsh and accurate light. Page 308. However, the deconstruction of leaders like that of all individuals in Brecht is extended into a reconstruction of the social and economic nexus in which the dictator acts. Instead of a conspiracy of the wealthy and powerful, we are given a trivial gangster organization, the Cabbage Trust. The true horror of fascism is conjured